Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, Joseph Pache. Tonight we're talking about urban etiquette. When we think of manners and etiquette, what images come to your mind? Where did you learn your manners? Was it from a teacher, your grandparents, a neighbor? Or maybe Emily Post, the Bible, or Sesame Street? To quote Eleanor Roosevelt, the basis of all good human behavior is kindness. But sometimes even that's challenging in often cramped urban settings where people share space and often way too much information. From cafes to sidewalks to public transportation and social media, how do we know what the ever-changing rules are? And who makes those rules? Which communities and power structures do the rules reflect? And what happens when etiquettes collide? Joining me in the studio this evening to discuss these issues and more are Charles Purdy, the author of the manners guidebook, Urban Etiquette, and a former etiquette advice columnist whose column ran in the SF Weekly for 5 years. Charles is currently a partner at Moxie Creative, a marketing and copywriting agency. Welcome, Charles.
Thank you. It's a real pleasure to be here.
And we're also joined in the studio by Shonda Jaw. She serves as the director of the Oakland Peace Center, a collective of nonprofits creating peace through access, opportunity, and dignity for all people in Oakland and the Bay Area. She is co-pastor of First Christian Church of Oakland and an anti-racism trainer for the Disciples of Christ Church, a mainline denomination across the United States. Welcome, Shonda.
It's a delight to be here.
And by phone, we're joined by Daniel Post Senning. Yes, the great-great-grandson of Emily Post and co-author of Emily Post's Etiquette in its 18th edition and author of the new book, Manners in a Digital World, Living Well Online, about tech and social media etiquette. Dan conducts business and children's etiquette seminars for the Emily Post Institute, where he writes the Q&A blog The Etiquette Daily, and he has appeared on ESPN and has been featured in The New York Times, Esquire Magazine, and The Wall Street Journal. Welcome, Dan.
It's my pleasure to be here.
And, of course, we welcome you, our listeners, to join our conversation. You can dial our phone-in line at 415-841-4134 in about 20 minutes. You can talk about all things etiquette. You can even call in for an etiquette consultation if you'd like. Again, that's 415-841-4134. You can email us now at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com. You can post a comment at the KLW website, klw.org, or you can post a comment on our Facebook page. So, Daniel Post Senning, I wanted to start with you. Tell us about how the notions of etiquette are changing, especially in our ever more cramped urban spaces.
Sure. Well, I'll start off from the, I guess, the perspective of a five-generation family business in etiquette. And something that we've noticed is that every generation witnesses the changes that occur in manners over a lifetime and thinks that perhaps manners are in a state of decline. But what we've also noticed is that there's a constant renewing that goes on, and a discussion like the one that we're having today is part of that renewal, where each generation figures out what works for it in terms of the specific manners or the specific behaviors that articulate a functional set of values. And those values change less than you might think. I love that when you started off and you wandered from Eleanor Roosevelt to the Bible, and sometimes people talk about the golden rule of doing unto others or treating others the way we'd like to be treated, but even just thinking about other people and the way our actions affect others really, to me, is the heart of etiquette. And whatever form it takes, that core, that heart, seems to stay the same.
So you're saying that the more we talk about etiquette, the more that our day-to-day lives and situations evolve, that for the most part the rules are pretty much unchanged, or the conventions are pretty much unchanged?
Or the conventions change, but the heart of the matter, the values that are expressed by those conventions, in many ways don't change all that much. You treat people with respect. You operate from a place of sincerity. You think about other people when you operate. In one era, that might mean that you follow a certain convention when you exchange greeting cards. In another era, that might mean that you don't send a Facebook friend request until you've met someone in real life first. But either way, there's a respect that's afforded to others and an awareness of how our actions impact others that matters.
Okay. But can you note anything that you would say has changed, or are you pretty much thinking it's pretty much all the same?
Ooh. know, I really do think that the heart of the matter, changes very little. But boy, the world, the conditions of the world that we all live in change so much that there's a great deal of flux, and particularly right now, some people think that we're going through more changes more rapidly than we have in the past. Maybe some of that's related to a faster and faster communication environment, but that once again, that concern for each other and awareness of human relationships as being what is fundamentally important about how we treat each other, that's again, what stays the same and what continues to matter.
So is it that even if there's a seemingly new scenario you find yourself in, that it reduces to a sort of a finite number of appropriate rules of engagement? Is that what you're saying? That you can sort of...
You're drilling down to the heart of the matter very quickly. Absolutely.
Okay, so that even a novel situation can sort of be built on a certain principle that you say, well, you know, no matter if it's, you know, a phone, a dial phone versus a cell phone versus, you know, email, that's sort of it's all a communication tool. And so when you talk about communication tools, these principles tend to dominate. Is that
from the Pony Express to the transatlantic cable? Oh. Absolutely.
Okay. So then why do people feel like things seem so confusing, or that the rules are changing, when you're saying they really aren't changing? What is it about the way we engage with understanding the covenant, let's say, of etiquette, not to get too biblical about it, but that sort of makes people always have to kind of rethink and feel like they're totally kind of disoriented and facing a new situation?
Two things. One, I think what we're already talking about, that the conditions that we all operate in are changing all the time, and there's generational change. So the particular communication choices or attire choices or even the range of possibilities in terms of what one does in public, those continue to change and evolve. Again, the heart of the matter stays the same, but there's another element that I think factors into all good etiquette, and it's something that I've sort of been alluding to or assuming in the way I talk about what's fundamentally important, and that's an awareness of others. But even in the awareness of others, there's the idea of awareness, and we're all programmed to habituate actions. You don't relearn to tie your shoes every morning. You don't relearn to walk every day. We're all creatures of habit, and we need to be. That's how we continue to function. But it's also true that we habituate actions and behaviors that aren't as functional as tying our shoes or walking, or our rote behaviors aren't always as practical or as good as we'd like. And there is also a process that every generation goes through. Even people who are aware of good etiquette or aware of proper or correct behavior, there's a continual process of self-assessment and reassessment to continue to engage those behaviors, to bring that awareness into each situation that we find ourselves in. Mm. So whether the conditions are changing or not, I think etiquette is a continual challenge for each of us, and it's true for me, and I assume it's true for others.
So you have to kind of stumble over it a little bit a couple of times before you realize, oh, wait a minute, I need to be mindful of this situation. And then you take the next step, which is to say, okay, let me run through my matrix of situations and find a way to plug this in. Okay, that's a really helpful frame for the rest of our conversation. And that was Daniel Post-Senning. He's joining us tonight from Vermont, and he's the great-great-grandson of Emily Post, and we'll hear more from you in just a moment. I want to turn to our guests here in the studio next, and let's start with Charles Purdy, who is the author of the Manners Guidebook called Urban Etiquette, from which we take tonight's title of our program, and also was a former etiquette advice columnist for SF Weekly. So what's your take, Charles, on Daniel's initial comments about the fact that, you know, the rules of etiquette really don't change all that much, although we keep seeming to need to refresh ourselves on how to handle novel situations?
I'm nodding along in agreement, and the analogy I like to use is the analogy of language. Language changes over time. It's supposed to change over time. It changes as society changes and technology changes, but it's still communicating the same sort of ideas, and that's what etiquette rules do. The rules change, but they are still communicating the same fundamental ideas, as Daniel was saying, of respect for others, respect for their privacy, their safety, and their comfort as far as is possible in what you say is a crowded and sometimes uncomfortable world. And not only does the language change over time through generations, but it's also changes by context. What is good manners in one social situation or in one group is not the same as what's good manners in another social situation or in another group of people. And I think that's a stumbling block for people as well, is what they want is a list of easy answers. Do these five things, don't do these five things, and you have, quote, good manners. And it's just not as simple as that. Just like learning a language isn't as simple as that. You have to really do some work and give some thought and do some practice. The same sort of is true of etiquette. You can't just live by this set of rules. You have to really think, as Daniel was saying, about the fundamental ideas and how they might be applied in a new situation. You had a quote from Eleanor Roosevelt up front, and she has a great quote in her book, in an etiquette book she wrote after the Roosevelts left the White House, and I'm going to be misquoting her, but it's something like, if ever following any of the etiquette rules in this book would be unkind, then forget the rule and be kind instead. And that is good manners. And I love that quote and that idea because it's very helpful when you get to a place where people are using etiquette rules, as often happens. They're using their understanding of a rule to sort of bludgeon someone else into place or to say this person has bad manners because they don't know this rule. That sort of is the antithesis or the opposite of what good manners should be. It's really about, as Daniel was saying, communicating respect and doing it in the right way that's appropriate for the context that you might find yourself in.
So there's this, would you go as far as saying that sort of what to do in a situation, the good-mannered thing to do is sort of in your gut? It's sort of, you sort of use your gut to judge, or would you not go that far?
If you have a well-tuned gut, perhaps you can listen to your gut. Knowing the rules is helpful because a lot of the times the rules are helpful because they give you a basic idea on which to build and help you understand how the fundamentals work. Again, I think language is a good analogy. If you don't speak a language well, it's very easy to accidentally insult someone or to express an idea that you don't really mean. If you do know a language well, you're much more able to communicate what you want to say, even in an unusual situation or an odd situation. The good thing is that the rules of the language of etiquette and manners are a lot easier than the rules of French or Spanish or Mandarin, much easier to learn. They do require that we pay attention, and I think that's the hard part for a lot of people, is really being aware of what's going on around you and being aware of the other people around you. Having good manners is not simply about you being perfectly well-mannered. Having good manners is about making sure that the other people around you are at ease or are comfortable or at least not put out by your behavior.
Okay. So instead of saying, you know, these are the things you're supposed to do in X, Y, and Z situations, so you're covered no matter what you come up against, are there certain sort of questions or framing tools that you would suggest people use to guide them in novel situations?
Right. I think that's a really good question to ask. And we can go back to the very fundamental questions like, is this going to be hurtful to someone else in terms of their comfort or their safety or their privacy? Those are the three big areas that etiquette sort of works to protect, in my view. You can also sort of ask yourself, what do I know about how I'd like to be treated in this situation? The whole golden rule thing. And then you can use the knowledge of what your knowledge of the foundations of good manners and the etiquette rules that you're familiar with in your context and see how they might be applied in the situation.
Say, have I been in a situation like this before?
Right. It can be as simple as that. Or what do I like to happen around me? And that can be very helpful, I think, especially in an urban area. And we are in San Francisco or in the San Francisco Bay Area, where there is a lot of culture collision. People from all over the world are in the Bay Area, and they have very different expectations about what is polite and what is impolite. I think the further step for having good manners is an especially important step is being forgiving and lenient and understanding that other people have different ideas from you, and understanding that you're going to have to give a little. Living together means that sometimes everyone is a little bit uncomfortable, and sometimes you have to be a little bit uncomfortable so that no one is super uncomfortable, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. And sometimes that's what good manners means.
Okay.
Sharing the discomfort equally.
Interesting. Wonderful. So that was Charles Purdy. He's author of the guidebook Urban Etiquette and former etiquette advice columnist for SF Weekly. And I want to turn next to Shonda Jha. She's director of the Oakland Peace Center, diversity trainer, and co-pastor of First Christian Church of Oakland. So, Shonda, the thoughts that were coming to mind as I was hearing Charles and Daniel speak were I picked up on a couple of things like proper behavior, politeness, mm-hmm. You know, the checklist that people want that's mm-hmm. sort of like in the realm of cultural competency.
Yeah.
And I've learned lately about this concept of cultural humility,
right.
Coined by a physician in the East Bay, Melanie Turvalon at Children's Hospital of Oakland. Mm-hmm. And thinking about that, when we talk about, you know, there's an aspect of manners and etiquette that's about sort of, are you civilized enough?
Mm-hmm.
Are you cultured enough?
Right.
Are you going to do something that's going to make you stand out and draw some unnecessary attention to yourself? And I'm wondering, you identify as a mixed race individual, mm-hmm. your father being Indian and your mom Scottish. And I just wonder, as not representing all mixed race people, or, you know, I wouldn't do it that way, of course. But just from that perspective,
yeah.
How do we navigate what, you know, who writes these rules? Who
right.
are they for? Who are they meant to sort of exclude?
Right.
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 As we talk about this more, and as I was saying to you before the program, how do we determine what's, you know, etiquette, bad etiquette, good etiquette,
mm-hmm.
what versus what's racism and bias?
Right.
You know?
Right.
So a lot there, but I wanted to give it all to you to kind of unpack. And then for listeners, we're going to get into etiquette scenarios in a moment, but I just want to make sure we get to this part
Fabulous.
First.
And one of the things that Charles was talking about just a moment ago really kind of brought that home for me, because I think all of us who live in this area are functionally living in a global village. And the other day I was walking to work and I was in Old Oakland, which is a cute little neighborhood. It's right across the road from Chinatown. And there was somebody walking down the street and they very loudly cleared their throat and spat in the sidewalk. And I found myself thinking, huh, two blocks away, that's normative behavior.
In Chinatown.
Mm. Which I'm very sympathetic to, because it's very much the norm in Indian communities as well. And I've grown up with that. What it made me think about was that so much of our etiquette is shaped by our values, and particularly our values about what makes a functioning community. And the challenge I think we face is that the reality is that we end up creating norms. And so many of us are unaware of the power elements that go into that, the power and privilege that kind of create, here's the norm that we are going to preference. I find myself thinking about my own congregation. We nest a Mongolian congregation. Now, my congregation's predominantly African American and a few white folks and some of us who are Asian American, but pretty assimilated into American culture. And we nest this Mongolian congregation that's first generation. Last Sunday, we walked into the building, and the kitchen that we have said about 12 times cannot be used. It is a fire hazard. It is dangerous. We walked in and found the Mongolian congregation cooking a huge meal for about 100 people. And the automatic response from my congregation was, we're changing the locks. We're charging the church to change the locks. Enough is enough. This is a violation of basic rules of civility. We've asked politely about 5 or 6 times. couple of days later, I was in a training on multicultural congregational life, and somebody said, you know, there's an example from the Bible where when a situation like this comes up, the community, the diasporan community, is asked to determine how to handle the new mixed community's rules. And I found myself thinking, wow, I really screwed that one up. Mm. We have never once thought to ask the congregation, how do you think that we should be navigating this together? And that's because although we think of ourselves as a congregation on the margins, as mostly people of color, we really do benefit from a lot of privilege and power we're not aware of. And that impacts the way we've engaged our brothers and sisters in the Mongolian church.
Very interesting. And I'd like to hear a little bit more again as we go through the program of how we write rules of etiquette to be as inclusive mm-hmm. as possible and not use it as ways to deny access to certain rights and privileges and benefits. Because I think that's a really key question for how we move forward as we become yeah. a much more diversified area. But before I go there, I want to reintroduce the program. This is City Visions on 91.7 KALW San Francisco and on the web at kalw.org. I'm Joseph Pache, and tonight, we're talking about urban etiquette with our guests, Charles Purdy, author of the Manners Guidebook Urban Etiquette and former etiquette advice columnist for SF Weekly, Daniel Post Senning, who's joining us by phone from Vermont. He's the great-great-grandson of Emily Post, co-author of Emily Post's Etiquette in its 18th edition, and author of Manners in a Digital World, Living Well Online. And just there, we were hearing from Shonda Jaw. She's director of the Oakland Peace Center Diversity Trainer and co-pastor of the First Christian Church of Oakland. 415-841-4134 is the number to dial to join our conversation. Again, 415-841-4134. You could email us at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com, post a comment on the KALW.org website, or post a comment on our Facebook page. So, Charles, it looks like you wanted to say something there.
I wanted to say something. Shonda brought up an interesting idea that is something that is very prevalent among subcultures, and that's the whole idea of manners and etiquette code switching as mm-hmm. you move from one milieu to another. And I think just as we, again, the analogy of language I think is really important, just as we naturally, all of us change the way we speak as we go from our professional life to our home life to this social group to that social group. The rules of what is considered proper behavior or good etiquette change as well. And I think that's normal. And I think not only is it normal, but it's sort of necessary and important in the way that changing our language is important, just because the same way of communicating, whether it's verbal or through your actions as far as etiquette, has to change. We live in a complex society. So the good thing, again, is I think that manners rules are much easier, again, to learn and to understand than language rules because they are much less arbitrary. They are all based on that idea of a foundation of respect.
Great, Daniel, go ahead.
I'd love to jump in and sort of piggyback onto something Charles was saying there. I love this idea of being fungible, being able to adapt and adjust as your situation changes, as you move from work to public to home life. And a theme that I'm finding is emerging for me a lot lately is that we do live in an increasingly diverse and complex world, oftentimes an increasingly informal or casual world where we're each asked to go through these changes more and more often in this new global village. Mm-hmm. And it really does. It places a lot of demands on the individual to navigate that space well. And it has surprised me as I've gotten older how sort of comfortably my conservatism is emerging in that I'm really finding a lot of the traditional etiquettes or guidelines, while they might not be practically applicable, that they came into being because they stood the test of time. They stood the test of functioning for whatever community they worked in. And the particular behaviors or norms that have really had generational staying power, I think, start to be some really functional and good guideposts when we're in that decision-making space or the new territory of urban etiquette today. And it can be fun if you don't feel trapped by them, if you're not in Eleanor's world where they're forcing you to be unkind. Those traditional norms can be functional guideposts in a decision-making process. And like I said, I've enjoyed sort of playing with and getting into that territory just a little bit.
So if you can think back and sort of invoke your great-great-grandmother for a moment, what would you say was the kind of, what was the context in which she wrote about etiquette and manners? Did she write about it in this inclusive sort of multicultural way, even though she probably came from a society that was less multicultural than our current one? I'm not sure. Or inhabited one is what I meant to say.
Oh, absolutely.
How has that shifted?
I love talking about Emily in Her Moment.
Mm-hmm. So can you briefly tell us about Emily in Her Moment and tell me, you've edited the 18th edition, how have you noticed that even though the context has changed, the text still applies and the text still lives and is applicable?
I was reading her 1922 edition, her first edition, just this morning. Mm. And what her fundamental belief in human reason, that if we would just think, that we're at our best when we're thinking creatures. And I love to tell people that Emily was a career woman. She was a divorcee. She wrote to support herself and her two children. Her scandalous cad of a stockbroker husband was caught in a tawdry affair, and his fortunes were at a low ebb. He couldn't pay the tabloid gossip columnist who was extorting money from him. So anyway, sting, police hidden closets, money changed hands, people were arrested. It was a scandal that she was divorced. She started off writing romance novels and sort of found her way to writing about etiquette through a roundabout way. She was asked by an editor who she'd worked for serially. Emily's first nonfiction title was called By Motor to the Golden Gate. She took a road touring car from New York to the Golden Gate Bridge before there were paved roads west of the Mississippi. I get to say Emily and Jack Kerouac in the same sentence. She's part of the great American road trip tradition. But anyway, a divorcee, a working woman, a career woman, would have been shocking to many people who thought of Emily as an arbiter of the best society's social standards, where divorce wasn't done, wasn't an acceptable option, and yet that was Emily. She was an amazing woman, was incredibly close with her father, the architect Bruce Price, who was a brilliant man, the Frontenac in Quebec, Tuxedo Park outside New York. If she'd been a man, she would have been an architect. She applied her father's Enlightenment-era values and principles and concepts. She was a favored daughter to her area of agency at the time, the social sphere.
So you would say that she would be very comfortable in this conversation we're having tonight?
She loved youth culture and new media, absolutely.
Because I'll tell you, when the image of Emily or the name Emily Post is invoked, the way it's been talked about is like Miss Manners, as if it's this sort of like, very proper way of being. And it's sort of, again, about being bound by rules and not very flexible and breathed, doesn't breathe, and it's stuffy. And it's about, again, what's proper and not proper, and it's about drawing lines of sort of exclusion.
And it couldn't be any further from the truth. One of the things that was so remarkable about Emily was she was a democratizer of manners. Her first edition really, in some ways, took the form of, I'm going to make available to the new industrial urban middle classes the codes of conduct that have been the code by which the upper crust have identified themselves. By her third or fourth edition, the very tone of the book had changed. She had introduced Miss 3-in-1, the woman who could host a dinner party without a staff. So she was both the cook and the server and the hostess. She was Miss 3-in-1. She didn't emerge till about the third or fourth edition. But it was Emily's awareness of the middle class and their practical, the emerging middle class and their very practical needs, that it wasn't just about revealing what best society did to give everyone access, which was her first sort of democratizing idea. But the second democratizing idea was, I'm going to articulate a set of standards that are good for everybody. And those really started to emerge in subsequent editions.
Hmm. So I wanted to get your take, Shonda and Charles. What do you make of Daniel's take on his great-great-grandmother and the, you know, and how democratic she was? Charles.
I agree completely as a you know, a student of etiquette over the years. And I think the best writers, people like Emily Post and Amy Vanderbilt, too, would be totally comfortable in modern society and pretty comfortable with our more liberal mores and attitudes. And they were, as Daniel was saying, democratizing agents. And I think it's interesting when you talk about what the notion of etiquette is as this formal, stuffy set of rigid rules. It isn't. And the idea that we have fewer or less rigidity now is sort of a false one, I think. If I were to try to write an etiquette book to help someone from 1910 or 1920, someone very well brought up, and to help them acclimate to our world today, I would have to give them a long list of rules that might seem very strange and very rigid to them. Manners rules don't go away, they just change. An example I like to give is an example of, we have an unspoken etiquette rule in our modern culture, and it's very rigid and it's very strict, and it's about hygiene. We have an unspoken rule. It's so ubiquitous that we don't even talk about it, and that is the taboo against the smell of body odor and the requirement that we wash ourselves so frequently and so often in a way that even someone in very polite society, a Victorian, a very civilized and well-mannered Victorian, would find rather bizarre and also sort of rigid. So the rules don't go away, they just change. And when we think about manners rules, often what comes to our head is the notion of, you know, beautiful calligraphy on a formal invitation and things like that. That's part of it. But manners rules are really also often so encultured in us that we don't even think about them. And I think the hygiene thing is a good example.
Hmm. But I'm also thinking about, you know, sitting down to like the 25-piece place setting and that kind of, how do you navigate all that, and finding that that would, you know, make a lot of people uncomfortable because they'll feel sort of that their pedigree or lack thereof is going to become pretty evident when they don't know which fork to use. So I'm going in that direction. Shonda, I want you to speak to this.
Well, it's really interesting because I think you had lifted up the theme of cultural humility, and it's really interesting to kind of think about how in some ways that was embedded in Emily Post's work in slightly different ways. There's this thing that you may have already heard of called the platinum rule, right? Rather than do unto others as you would have them do unto you, it's do unto others as they want you to do unto them.
Say that again.
I love it.
Say that one more time.
I love it. That's phenomenal.
Yes, do unto others as they would want you to do unto them. Hmm. And I think that's that cultural humility that you were getting at. It's that idea of recognizing that the other person's needs are part of what we take into account as part of how we manage to build this very diverse community. And I do think that at its heart, etiquette is about creating a healthy and functioning community, just out of very diverse elements at this point.
I want to reintroduce the program. This is City Visions on 91.7 KALW San Francisco and on the web at KALW.org. I'm Joseph Pache, and we're talking about urban etiquette with our guests, Charles Purdy, author of the Manners Guidebook Urban Etiquette, Shonda Jha, director of the Oakland Peace Center, diversity trainer and pastor of the First Christian Church of Oakland, and Daniel Post Senning, great-great-grandson of Emily Post, co-author of Emily Post's Etiquette and Manners in a Digital World, Living Well Online. We have a couple of callers waiting to get on the show. We'll get to you in just a moment. Others, you may call in at 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. Where did you learn your manners? Are we living in a time of etiquette anarchy, perhaps? Mm-hmm. How did or didn't you resolve a difficult social situation that you encountered recently? Do you have an etiquette consultation question that you'd like to call in about? 415-841-4134. You can post a comment at klw.org, at our Facebook page, or email us at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com. And to shift the conversation a little bit towards more urban etiquette scenarios that kind of will make us all nod in recognition, I want to welcome part of the program, Mary Gilley. She's professor of marketing at UC Irvine's Paul Mirage, I'm assuming I'm pronouncing that correctly, School of Business, and co-author of the study DIBS, Customer Territorial Behaviors, published in the Journal of Service Research. Welcome, Professor Gilley.
Thank you, Joseph. I appreciate being here.
So tell us a little bit about the study you conducted and how it applies to the conversation we've been having tonight.
Well, my co-author, Merlin Griffiths, and I did research on how consumers in commercial establishments, particularly coffee shops, display territorial behaviors to shut other consumers out and claim the space as their own. When Howard Schultz, for example, started Starbucks, his idea was it was going to be a third place in the sociological sense of first place being home, second place being work, third place being community gathering places. And he thought we would all be, Howard Schultz thought we would all be mingling, and, you know, the construction worker would be chatting with the lawyer and so forth about community issues. And what it's become is where, as Sherry Turkle's book says, we're alone together. We're communing with our screens, not with the people around us. And so we, you know, put our jacket on, you know, one chair and stack our books on another chair and do everything we can to have a literal barrier between ourselves and other people.
And so tell us what you found.
Well, we conducted interviews with both consumers and employees, and we had them write stories about their experiences and so forth. And what we found is consumers end up in conflict with one another about use of space, mainly because they have different philosophies about it. Some people believe in rights of first come, first priority. So if you're in that chair, no one else can take that chair away from you. You can sit there, you know, till the place closes down. There's other people that believe in what we call rent and perpetuity, where you buy something and you can stay there the rest of the day. You can nurse that one cup of coffee for 8 hours if you want. And then the third philosophy is the rent until consumed. You buy something and you have the right to space, you know, to sit at a chair and table as long as you're consuming the product. But once you've finished your item, you make space for other consumers to consume their items as well. And so if different consumers have different philosophies, the ones that believe in, you know, rent until consumed are really going to have conflicts with the other two groups that are taking up space that they believe doesn't belong to them anymore.
Hmm. And Charles, I want you to comment on, I'm sure this is a common occurrence in San Francisco and the Bay Area. tell us what, from your standpoint as the author of the book Urban Etiquette, how are we supposed to untangle this problem, this idea that people are just basically hoarding social spaces?
I mean, it's a good question, and it's something interesting I think I've seen with in public spaces is the idea that one's comfort can't infringe too far on someone else's comfort. And I think the first come, first served, who was there first, generally the way that we establish that, because it's so widely understood as a rule. I don't know.
Anything? Would you add anything there, Daniel?
Only that if we could put our cell phones down long enough in the Starbucks to talk about it, we could probably reach some accord.
right.
the cell phone security blanket phenomenon, it's interesting because I haven't thought about it so much as a territorial question as an observer witnessing the behavior of that alone togetherness or together alone.
It's interesting because one of my favorite cafes in Oakland has established laptop-free weekends because they are oriented around that third space principle. And I don't think I'm allowed to use names of actual businesses.
I'm looking at our engineer. He says, go ahead.
Okay. So Actual Cafe in Oakland actually has laptop-free weekends so that they can be building up that sense of community, and that's the way they're resolving that issue.
Well,
it's really important.
The people that come in and buy something and want to sit down and consume the product that they purchased from the coffee shop, and there's no space to sit down. And so they get frustrated, so they don't come back. So that business is lost. And so it really is a business problem as well as an etiquette problem. And with all the teleworking, the free Wi-Fi and someplace nice to hang out. If you're tired of being at home in your bathrobe, you can come and actually be around people without actually, you know, interacting with them.
I'd love to.
The new corner office is the one close to the electrical outlet.
Right. Hold on, Mary. I think Dan wants to get in there with another comment.
Only that I hear Charles talking about an individual's willingness to undergo some discomfort for the sake of others. It's so funny. It's not an approach to etiquette I usually take. I'm usually trying to a relentless optimist, but there is time and opportunity in good behavior for taking one for the team, or you know, maybe even if you are a rent in perpetuity believer, where you say to yourself, you know, even though I bought my coffee, maybe I'll vacate this spot. I've been here for 2 hours, and it's someone else's turn. It seems really important.
Yeah, I think this willingness. One, I like the idea of this one having a hard and fast rule. I like a rigid rule for this one. I may have come across as not liking rigid rules, but in this case, I like one. Like a cup of coffee, an hour.
In situations like this, too, sometimes it is up to the authorities. I'm putting that in air quotes. Mm-hmm. So the authorities being the people who are in charge of that space to make the rules plain so people know and understand how to follow them. If you are the actual cafe in Oakland and you have a no laptops weekend, that's an etiquette rule that is specific to that place and helps people behave properly the way that that space wants them to behave. Mm-hmm. So it is sort of a responsibility of a business to be the authority in situations like that. It's interesting.
I wish I could tell you that works, but our research finds that it doesn't. For example, Panera tried having little signs on the table saying, we love having you here, but at busy times such as lunch, if you could move to a smaller table or maybe leave and come back, we'd really appreciate it. Those signs didn't last, you know, more than a month.
Wow.
Well, completely ignored.
Well, Mary Gilley, professor of marketing at UC Irvine's Paul, is it Marriage or Mirage?
Mirage.
Mirage School of Business and co-author of the study DIBS, Customer Territorial Behaviors, published in the Journal of Service Research. Thanks so much for joining us.
It was my pleasure.
Okay. 415-841-4134. Email us at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com. You can post comments at the KLW.org website or on our Facebook page as we talk about urban etiquette tonight on City Visions here with Charles Purdy, Shonda Jaw, Daniel Post-Senning, and that was Mary Gilley. So let's go to our patiently waiting listeners who are on the line. Start with Eddie from San Francisco. Welcome to the program.
Well, thank you. Your conversation about the cafes just got me onto a tangent of the actual comment I wanted to make. I experienced the same thing on Muni. I was the sole person on a bus, and I had sat in a two-person seat on the aisle. And a single person got on the bus and came back and wanted the seat next to me. Now, they clearly had something they wanted to accomplish with that. I don't know what it was, but I got up, let them have it, and sat down next to them.
You know, it wasn't me, by the way, but or maybe it was. There are times when I have a favorite seat on the Muni, and I really just want that seat, even if there's someone next to it. But anyway, who wants to help answer this etiquette consultation question? Are you, if there's multiple seats?
Actually, that's not my question.
Oh, okay. Well, I want the answer to that one.
I couldn't think of a good reason. That's a great one.
But my actual question is a little more personal. I'm from the Midwest. I moved here 25 years ago, and when I'm waiting on the Muni Underground, I have had a number of times when the train stops in front of me, the door opens, and I've had a number of senior women jump in front of me to get in there before I do, and my cultural background says they're seniors, you should be deferring to them, but there's a part of me that says, really? I'm right here. They don't acknowledge me. And I'm curious how that should be handled. I know how it feels like it should be handled, but after a number of times, I feel like, okay, that platinum rule is not being toward me at any point.
Go ahead.
It's difficult. I know it's difficult. It's difficult to do. It's difficult for me to do. But sometimes the test of good manners is maintaining yours even when other people don't have them. So, yes, you could say that these people are behaving in a way that you are perceiving as impolite. Perhaps in their context it isn't impolite and you're annoyed by it. I would put that to the test of, is this something I should be alerting the authorities about? If the answer is no, maybe it's something that I need to cope with on my own. This is a price I pay for the wonderful benefits of having a public transportation system in a crowded city, is that sometimes the other people are not going to live up to my standards. So what to do, I would say, in that is maintain your own high standards of manners and not try to correct other people's manners, because that is sort of an etiquette paradox, is telling someone that they have bad manners is itself the height of bad manners. You just can't do it.
But then how do we all learn if we don't correct each other?
Well, I think it's not our job to correct each other. It's our job to lead by example. Our correction, our ability to correct people sort of ends at our kids and our significant others. And even with significant others, you should tread very carefully, as everyone who has a significant other knows.
A-plus answer from Charles.
So Daniel, do you want to add something to that?
I couldn't.
Okay, and Shonda, I wanna get to
it feels like it falls into my category of being responsible myself.
Okay,
but it does, over the years, it's gotten more frustrating, and it's a little harder for me to hold my tongue.
Okay, and I'm wondering also, Shonda, to just take this in the diversity realm here for a moment, beyond age and generation. You know, different cultures also have different sense of personal space.
Yes.
How do we manage that in this situation? I'm not sure if there's an overlap or application here in Muni. Obviously, personal space in Muni is precious, except on the one bus you were on. But go ahead.
Yes, and I think what Charles lifted up is a really important part of that. Part of the bad news of that platinum rule is we don't get to demand that others apply it to us. We only get to, it's unidirectional towards other people. The only other thing I could add is, don't ever visit my family's home city of Calcutta and try to get on the subway. There are very different norms around what is appropriate personal space. And I think that's just something we have to... Sometimes I find a little bit of peace in reminding myself, oh, right, in a different person's setting, the fact that they're right on top of me, the fact that they're pushing in isn't considered impolite at all. Maybe there's some solace to be found there.
So Charles, Daniel, you wouldn't apply the tactic that some people do, which is the ironic excuse me?
Oh, I hate that.
Excuse me?
I hate that. There's nothing worse than taking words that are meant to express something beautiful and making them ugly with sarcasm. I really hate the rude excuse me or the rude thank you. Like,
right.
I think it's hideous.
Which brings me to the you know where I'm going here,
Shonda. I was just
thinking,
I really want to hear what he has to say about hipster racism.
Thank you. Go there.
So we were talking about...
So define it for us.
Right. So there's been quite a few articles popping up recently around incredibly enlightened people who are so aware of the complexities of racism and the way it oppresses people of color that if they use it ironically, it's supposed to be socially acceptable. And I think the argument that I buy into is... if it sounds racist, even if it's said ironically, it's probably racist. There's a great website called yoisthisracist.com. And the answer is almost always, if you have to ask, it probably is.
Right. Or like the common terms, where are you really from?
Uh-huh.
Right. Or if someone perhaps is of
mixed race. Mm-hmm.
Wow, you're so exotic.
Yes. Yes.
All no.
Exactly. Even when it's intended to be flattering, as a general rule, wanting to know about the individual rather than the construct is always the better rule of thumb, if we're looking for rules of thumb around etiquette.
Okay. 415-841-4134. We have a little less than 10 minutes in the program if you have an etiquette consultation. 415-841-4134 to join our conversation tonight. Let's go next to Dave from San Francisco. Welcome to the program, Dave.
Hey, how's it going, folks?
Okay.
I'm so glad we're having this conversation about sharing discomfort and diversity and racism. This is yet another situation related to Muni. I'll say off the bat that I don't think this is racist because I myself am Chinese. But one of the things that bugs me the most are very loud Chinese talkers on Muni, on a crowded train. The second is walking on the sidewalk and seeing old Chinese spit. And I think it's more than just discomfort, because I don't want to walk in your spit. And I'm curious what your panel would say about how to handle those situations where the cultural norm is different than what our cultural norm here is.
Who wants to take that?
I mean, my answer, I think, would be very much the same as my last answer, which is, I understand you're uncomfortable, but is this a situation where the police need to be involved? Are they putting your privacy and your safety in jeopardy? If the answer is no, then I would say try to find your happy place and walk on by. The thing is, the flip side of that is, people who are doing things like that are often, they either don't speak the local language of etiquette, they don't speak the local language of what proper behavior is. The misfortune for them is they're missing out on the full participation in the culture, just like a language allows you to participate fully. So if they do know the local language, but they're refusing to, they're choosing to
refute it. When you say language, you don't literally mean the language here.
I mean the language of etiquette, yes, the language
okay.
of cultural, the cultural language. Then that means they're probably not someone you're going to have a productive engagement with anyway. So, I mean, the answer, I think, is the same. I would just hold my head high and walk on by.
So before you you comment, Shonda, because mm-hmm. I think you would be a good person to go to with this one, I want to just challenge a little bit something that Dave said. Respectfully, Dave, with all due respect, this concept also that if you're from a particular group, you're excused to say, I can say this because I'm, in his case, he says, I'm Chinese. Tell us a little bit about that. I'm curious about this, that it's like I get the rights to point to something that's annoying behavior, if it's even politically incorrect or a little sensitive, because I'm from the same social group. What do you think about that?
Yeah, and I think a lot of us do that. I certainly have struggled with that myself as somebody who...
I mean, you just did. You talked about the trains in Calcutta, right?
That's exactly right.
Right.
And I'm very aware of the challenges of, particularly as somebody who has been assimilated pretty well into kind of the norms of the dominant culture within this country, when I see people, including people from my own cultural background, who don't follow those rules, don't know those rules, I'm sometimes a little bit embarrassed. So I think that's one of the challenges. I do find myself also thinking, though, God bless you. If spit is the worst thing you're walking through in the city of San Francisco, you are a lucky, lucky man. And I think that, I think that's, and I travel by bus, and I think that there's also an important issue of personal lines in the sand. There's a guy who does hip hop at the back of the bus that I travel every morning, and that's fine. He does his little chanting to himself, but anytime he uses the B word, I turn and look at him and say, I need you not to use that word. I think that there are some places where it's important to establish what's appropriate and what's healthy.
I'm glad you brought that up, because I was going to ask you a question around when there are situations where we've talked about cultural humility, mm-hmm. Talking about like really bending the curve, so to speak, on racism, that what happens, what would we tell our listeners is a good way of handling? We've been saying just lead by example. Mm-hmm. Does example also mean calling a racist joke out as racist?
Yes.
I want to hear from all three of our guests on this one, because it's, what if a house guest of yours or a dinner guest of yours makes a racist joke?
Mm-hmm.
What do you do with that person?
Absolutely.
Or in a public situation or in the workplace?
And I think there was something that Charles said around, is it legally damaging? And I also think that if etiquette really is about trying to construct a healthy community, and I really do think that's mm-hmm. at its core what it's about, part of that is saying, is this damaging to our community ethic? And I think that's a good place to draw those lines in the sand.
So how would you draw that line, Charles?
I agree with Shonda, and I think we're getting to that line where we talk about, are we experiencing more discomfort? Has this been pushed into an area where I am being so disrespected that something needs to be said? My my response when you hear that racist joke or someone says something inappropriate like that, I think the best response is to assume or pretend to assume that the other person misspoke and didn't mean what they said. My pat answer is, I'm sure you didn't mean that the way it sounded. And that gives them a chance to gracefully backpedal and gives it is a nice subject change, way to change the subject as well. Again, if they insist, then you have then you can be a little bit firmer. And this isn't about correcting someone's manners. This is about, as Shonda said, protecting the community space or protecting the social space, protecting the comfort of everyone. So, yeah, I agree with Shonda.
Okay. And Daniel, quick answer to that one because we have a couple of calls and an email we want to get to in the last couple of minutes.
Quick answer to the most complicated question.
Yes, of course.
Yeah, it's a hard one.
Is that you correcting my radio matters?
Everything I've been hearing sounds so intelligent. The question of standing, when you have standing to address a situation, and you usually don't, as Charles pointed out. It's one of the great ironies of etiquette. You really can't correct other people. In most situations, but you can look for someone who does, a server, an usher, a steward. Mm-hmm. Addressing a racist joke, I wish I could say that just every time you do, but you don't always, it's more circumstantial. If you think you can affect some change, if you can, if your own integrity is in question by not saying something, and would there ever be a situation where you'd hear someone say something racist and your integrity isn't questioned? There might be situations where you don't have standing to address it in the moment, or and it's not about being wishy-washy. It's about making a good choice.
And
we often say safety trumps etiquette.
Okay.
And
okay.
Someone's got a Heimlich maneuver, you knock the chair over and you get to them and you prevent them from choking or whatever.
Which is probably why it behooves our institutions to create safe spaces rather than putting the people out there to deal with it on their own. Go ahead.
My mother went to Saudi Arabia to teach etiquette. And she found herself in many situations where she, as a woman, didn't feel like she had her full rights and privileges. At the same time, she was in another country. That wasn't a place for her to be addressing what she saw as some real inequalities. So when do you bring these things up? It's a tricky question.
It's a choose your battles wisely kind of thing. Daniel, I'm going to have to cut you off because I want to get to at least one of our two callers. Andrea. Andrea, welcome to the program.
Yeah, I'm here.
Quickly, Andrea.
Okay, so quickly, I just want to say the comment about that she used, well, first of all, thanks for the B word thing, but the rule of thumb thing. Just to share with everybody, I'm sure you meant well, but rule of thumb was you came to be out of, you were only allowed to beat your wife with a stick that was the size of your thumb. So we might want to use a different figure of speech on that one.
Okay, thank you. Thank you so much, Andrea, for your call. Zach, are you there? Zach?
Yes, hi.
Hi, go ahead.
So I had an experience today that I've never had before, and I grew up in this city. And I was in Washington Square Park in North Beach in the noon hour. And this large Italian family came up, and a couple of them sat on the bench and some sat on the lawn. And they all had soda cans with their lunch. And these two elderly Asian ladies came up and just stood there and wanting their cans, wanting them to finish their soda. And it really tested my patience in a big way. The Italians kept looking at me like, you know, is this common? What's going on here? And the ladies, you know, were yakking back and forth among themselves, the two Asian ladies, and they stayed put until they got those soda cans, you know, 5-6 soda cans.
Okay, well, thanks so much, Zach, for your call. It seems like the couple of areas that have been brought up, I don't know if it's representative, but a couple of issues people have brought up is around conflict or around Asian cultures, and I think we need to devote a show to this very topic. So thanks to all of those who've called or emailed that we couldn't get to tonight. That's City Visions. I want to thank our guests, Charles Purdy, Shonda Jha, Daniel Posenning, and earlier we heard from Mary Gilley. Thanks to all for joining me this evening.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It was a great time.
Thank you so much.
For a link to this and other City Visions shows, to sign up for alerts and download podcasts, go to the City Visions page at kalw.org. Our engineer this evening was Eric Jansen. Our producer was Lisa Denenmark. Susie Britton is our senior producer. Join me next week when we talk about the future of public housing in San Francisco. This is Joseph Pache. Thanks for listening. Good night. Have a great week and be nice to each other.